This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
Welcome to the 30th Annual Writers Symposium by the Sea at Point Loma Nazarene University. I'm Dean Nelson on the journalism faculty at the university, and we are overjoyed to have Sandra Cisneros with us. She's the author of that very famous book, House on Mango Street, now in its 40th year, along with the novel Caramello and collections of short stories and poems titled Loose Woman, My Wicked, Wicked Ways, Woman Without Shame, Woman Hollering Creek, and many more. She's a MacArthur Genius Grant recipient and one of the most important voices in literature today. Sandra Cisneros, welcome to the Writers Symposium.
I gotta copy that and share it with my six brothers. Get a little respect.
Yeah, I hope you're feeling the love, right? So let's start this way. As I understand it, your first love as a child wasn't even writing, it was drawing. Is that correct? Even before you were writing?
Yes.
What were you drawing?
My family. Yeah, I drew my father with a cigarette, my mother, my older brother, Junior, Kiki, me, Carlos, Loyo, Mayo, Mando, like a xylophone.
That's very cool. But there was a teacher who noticed your drawing ability.
Yes.
Right? And she praised you. And this was the key for when you began to write.
Yes, yes.
How are those connected?
Well, you have to remember, I went to schools with an order of nuns that I like to call the unhappy housewives of God. And I don't think they expected to be teaching 40 kids, you know. I think they thought, I like to sing hymns. Or, you know, I'm going to write about my mystical experiences. But they got stuck with us, you know. Mm-hmm. So we changed schools in 1966. Thankfully, due to some frozen water pipes, just like in the book, The House on Mango Street. And we changed schools, and there was this wonderful lay teacher. Her name was Mrs. Sellers. And she saw me drawing, and she took the page. My heart leapt. And she took it to the front of the room, and she put a push pen in there, and she said, look what our new student has done. Wow, I had no idea that drawing was something positive until that moment. And I thought, oh, I fooled her. Because I had some little pointy blue glasses from the Sears. I thought, she thinks I'm smart. Oh, jole, you know, now I have to raise my hand and I have to be nice to her. And I felt sorry for her. And I said, ay, pobrecita. Ay, pobre. So I tried, you know, raise my hand, spoke in class, and my grades went slowly up. From D's and C's to C's and B's and eventually A's, thanks to her.
Because she gave you confidence?
She gave me something that will make anything grow, love. And we know when a teacher loves us.
Mm-hmm. And so that also unlocked this ability to write?
Well, I don't know. That school had poetry in my textbooks, and I just wrote in secret. I didn't show them to her. They were just a way for me to express things I didn't have words for. You know, I lived in the ghetto, but I was writing about clouds and sunsets and trees and the wind. Yeah.
Didn't you also visualize when you would go to the library, your name on the spine of one of the books?
That happened around that time, too. I went to the library every Saturday with my mom. And, you know, at that time, you had the card catalogs that were that long. You pull them out. You had to look through little index cards. And I ran into a dirty card that was all dog-eared, all smudged, bien chamagoso. And I stopped, looked at it. That must be a good book. And this is how everything started in my brilliant career. First year, I said, I want that. And I didn't know what the title would be, but I saw a book with the spine with my name on it, and I saw the dirty card in the catalog, and that's how I began. And everything begins like that. First you put it in your third eye, then you walk towards it, and one day you say it out loud.
Yeah. So you knew you wanted to write, but you didn't tell anybody that.
I had six brothers. Remember the six brothers? Yeah.
You had no expectation of it being a career or making money at it.
It wasn't on the menu. If it's not on the menu when you're a young girl, would you like to be an author? No. Why don't you teach? Why don't you work in the library? No one says, would you like to write a book? Right? That's not even on the menu.
Sure.
I think even your dad, when you said you wanted to be a writer, he said, why would you choose to be poor?
Well, that was later. You know, I didn't tell him that till after I finished my education.
Oh, okay. All right. But how did you respond to him when he said, why would you choose to be poor?
I don't think I answered. In my culture, you have to be very respectful to your father.
But you also didn't want the life that your mother had.
No, I just couldn't understand why my mother didn't control her fertility. You know, that's so important. You know, it's one of the second thing I say to young people. You know, the first thing I say is what my mother taught me. Earn your own money, especially if you're married, okay? Number two, control your fertility. Your fertility does not control you. And the third thing I tell young people is solitude is sacred. It's time for you to take care of you. Now that's important.
Good advice.
That's key, because when you're young, you think you have to have a boyfriend or a date or go to a party every weekend. I think it was lucky for me that I didn't have someone in my life until I was a lot older, and it was time that I could invest in myself.
Okay. So I'm still rolling over with the control your fertility. That's, I don't know, I'm kind of stuck on that one.
I think it's so important, especially right now. You know, whatever, you know, now. And the to me, the crime is we don't talk about it with young people. That's a crime, to just let kids figure it out by themselves. That's wrong. So I usually, when I come into a school, it's because I volunteer, and they can't fire me, so I can say it.
So, this is great. So then, you went to the Iowa Writers Workshop, this very prestigious...
Yeah, but I didn't know it was prestigious.
Well, still, you got in and you went there, but what I think is intriguing is you didn't like it.
No. I was silenced. You know how, like, when you go somewhere and when you speak and people look at you like you're out of your mind? So you learn to, and that's how I felt. You know, I had to be silent. And I hadn't felt like that since the days of the unhappy housewives of God, you know. So it was an experience. One of my classmates was Joy Harjo. Yeah, right? And Joy and I were both, we both felt like when we spoke, it was not well received. So I don't know if I would have made it if she hadn't been there.
So what I think is so interesting about that is you went on the poetry track at Iowa, but while you were at Iowa, you started writing House on Mango Street.
Well, I always wrote both.
Oh, okay.
I had always written both, but when I was applying, you had to apply for poetry or fiction. You couldn't apply for dual citizenship.
Yeah. And so when you told them you had these stories, they didn't care because they were basically stay in your lane, right?
No, it wasn't like that.
Okay.
I found my voice writing about my house, because all of us have something we're ashamed to talk about. And I didn't realize that the thing I was ashamed to talk about was my house until, you know, we're in a class, we're reading about houses, the kind of house we always read about. And I realized I'd never seen my house in a piece of fiction or in a film or in any art form written about with love. And I felt ashamed. I felt like quitting the program. And something happened over the weekend. I went from being depressed to getting angry and asking myself, why have I never seen my community written about with love? Why? That flipped a switch. And so I used my rage to write these little vignettes that became my book. But it began as a place of, I'll show you. I'm going to write about something, and you can't tell me I'm wrong. But that's what finding your voice is. Like, what is it that you know that no one else in this room knows? Make a list of 10 things that you witness, 10 things you know that no one else in your family knows, 10 things that you know that no one else in your community knows. 10 things that no one else in your church, in your economic class, in your gender, in your age group. You can go on and on and on and make this list and write from there. And that's your voice.
So you've also described yourself, though, as a poet activist.
Yes.
Why the activist part? Why not just a poet?
because no one wrote about us with love. So that's my activism.
That's the activism?
Yeah.
Okay.
You've been really open in writing about a season in your life that you really struggled with depression.
Yeah.
And I so admire your being open about that and wanting to get that kind of out in the sunlight. How do you think about that season now?
As well, you look back on it? I talk about it because I don't want someone else to live through a depression and be ashamed and be lost and not know what to do. And I feel that I came very close to suicide, and I was just lucky. And I want to share that story, not because I'm trying to be poignant or show off, but because I want to save other people who are going through a depression that maybe come from a working class background, and you don't know what to do with that, you know.
Yeah, I was so moved by this sentence where you said, I was tired of the nuisance of staying alive.
Yeah, well, when you're depressed, being alive is a lot of work.
It is. Does writing help? What does writing help?
I wasn't writing during that period. I moved. I couldn't find a job where I lived, so I had to go to another state, California. I was living in a town called Little Chico, and I was teaching for the first time at a university where I had never felt comfortable as a student. So imagine me being the professor, and everything that went wrong, I thought it was my fault. So I really was beating myself up. I taught September, October, November, and I almost didn't make it to December. But a friend of mine who recognized how dangerously ill I was forced me to go home. And I had my partner living with me, and he said, if you leave, we're done. And he would cry. But when you're with someone who cries, you have no tears. It's like an equation. If one person cries, the other person doesn't have to. That's what I think. So,
Hold it. Where did that come from?
My life.
All right.
Yeah, right. And he would cry and say, you have to go see somebody. And I was just like, And finally, my friend said, no, you're coming to Chicago. I have an appointment with a therapist. And if you don't come, I'll come get you. And I was so frozen with grief. I couldn't refuse or say yes, or went home and lost my partner. And when I got home, my mother said, there's a letter from the National Endowment of the Arts in Washington, D.C. I think it's good news. And I'd forgotten that I'd applied and that my mother's address was the only permanent address I had. So I had my coat on, my suitcases, I rip open the envelope. Congratulations, you have been awarded a grant for $20,000. I was like, what? I just was reminded at that moment, I was put on the planet to write. And someone who wasn't related to me was giving me $20,000 to return to my desk. I could pay all my bills. I could quit the job in Chico, California. And I told my mother, Ma, give me a piece of paper. And you know, My mom didn't finish ninth grade, so she doesn't have pretty paper with her name on it. She had a ring binder. She tore off a sheet. She gave it to me with lines on it, and I wrote to the National Endowment for the Arts. And I said, "You have saved my life." And I meant it.
Wow. Yeah. We're glad.
You have saved my life. And you know, when they were deciding whether, you know, Sandra Cisneros gets this grant or not, was at my lowest low. So those grants are going to disappear in the next couple of weeks from the National Endowment for the Arts. But they are so important for working class artists. And we need to keep them alive. Yeah. I count my life from before I was 33 and after. And everything that has been great in my life happened afterwards. And I think how close I came to destroying my life.
That is harrowing to hear how close that was. So,
I think I have spirit guides protecting me because I don't know how to explain it otherwise. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. No, I believe that. So I want to talk maybe if we could about something more concrete and practical, just for a moment, and that is the difference between writing and publishing.
Yes.
So you've got this wonderful, colorful imagery where you say, "I write poetry because I had to push the truth out from my womb." So we've got that. And then publishing felt as if I was celebrating the messy afterbirth. So you've actually said this in many different contexts. Writing is one thing, publishing is another thing. I think we get those things mashed together a lot, that if I'm gonna write, I need to find it an outlet for it, I need to get it published. Why don't you think that's so important?
Well, I published my first book of poetry when I was 27, something like that. And I realized that writing poetry is necessary for me to heal myself. But publishing is the opposite. It's not about me, it's about, you know, other people. I don't have to, especially since I have the luxury of writing fiction too. So I decided after that first book that I wasn't gonna publish my poems. They were too personal. They came from like my uterus. They came from things that I was often ashamed about or afraid of saying or not proud of. So I didn't have anything to do with selling them, but it had something essential to do with birthing. So, you know, I felt for a long time that I needed to write poetry, but real poetry was words I couldn't publish in my lifetime. I had to throw them under the bed, like Emily Dickinson. And it did something wonderful for my writing. It liberated me.
Took the pressure off?
It took away the biggest censor, me. And I was able to write as if what I had to say couldn't be published in my lifetime. And that became key to me, to erase the listener and to allow myself to speak from a very pure place.
So you said that also, though, that you wasted a lot of time writing about love.
I did. Yeah.
Well, yeah, but it gets better. You said because women waste a lot of time writing about love. Now I'm looking for love from more reliable sources. I would like to know, what are those reliable sources?
Oh, my dogs.
There it is.
Yeah. And trees. and clouds and birds and mountains and land. And, you know, love, it's, I feel like Lucy in Peanuts. Remember how she's always looking for love and Snoopy's there like, eh, you know. Well, I feel like I was looking for love in all the wrong places because like the clouds are sending me love, the mountains, the wind, the flower, the same things I wrote about when I was a kid, sunsets, all of those things are giving me this beautiful universal love, animals, and I just savor it, especially because I live in Mexico, and I feel I'm just like the luckiest person on the planet.
Well, so many of your poems, though, the published ones, are about longing and love and desire and former lovers, and now you're writing about inanimate things?
No, my next book is pretty sexy. My next book is a love triangle, and you know, I want to understand why people haunt us that are alive, and how we're haunted by people who are dead. And I really want to explore, you know, the border crossing of the spirit world and the physical world, because as I told you, I'm an intuitive and a medium, and so are you. Everybody is, but...
I knew you were going to say that, but go ahead.
Writers practice it. It's just everybody's a medium, and it's just that writers practice it by sitting meditation, and everybody has this gift. You know, sometimes you'll say, the phone rings, I was just thinking about you. Well, that's your radar disc, you know. We all have this, but some of us have it more than others. And I've had it my whole life, but my family made me dismiss it and think of it as, you know, something not real. And, you know, I've slowly been trying to understand it. And this next novel, my protagonist is an intuitive, a clairvoyant, a medium, and that's going to be my way to explore it
and understand it.
I don't understand it. It just happens to me.
Sure.
Yeah.
And then there's a poem about underwear.
Oh, yes.
You wrote, I'd rather wear none than underwear made for women of a certain age.
Yes, yes.
Rage, no, it gets better. Rage, rage, do not go into that good night wearing sensible white or beige. That's you.
Well, why does underwear turn only white, black, or beige after a certain size? What's that about?
All I'm saying is I think it's wonderful that you can find anything to write a poem about.
Well, I think there's some young person out there that can create some wonderful underwear for women of a certain size and age.
The challenge has been...
It's out there.
It's out there. So how do you, but seriously, how do you know when you have something that is poem worthy?
Well, I never ask. I just write, and if it takes me, it's like flying a kite. You know, you give it rope, and you run. You have to stalk a poem. You know, you just can't. You gotta run, give it some rope. Sometimes it gets stuck in a tree. Too bad, start all over. And sometimes it lifts off, and your feet go up, and you're in the sky, and then you know you have a poem.
That makes perfect sense to me. So here's, no, it does. But there are so many things about your writing that is so beautiful, but here's one of the ones that has my attention, because I've read so much of your stuff. Your use of color in your writing is so powerful, especially in Carmelo, which I loved more than all of your other books.
You know, you have raised in my esteem by loving my favorite book. So thank
you. Oh, good. I'm so glad. We're on good footing here. So first you describe the men's cars A white Cadillac, a red Chevrolet station wagon, a green Impala. These are all colors in the Mexican flag. So then you've got this wonderful paragraph. I think this is my favorite paragraph of the entire book. Here it is, where you describe the skin of Candelaria. You say, she has skin bright as a copper coin after you've sucked it, not transparent as an ear like anti-light skins, not shark belly pale like father and the grandmother, not the Red River clay color of mother and her family, not the coffee with too much milk color like me, nor the fried tortilla color of the washerwoman Amparo, her mother, not like anybody, smooth as peanut butter, deep as burnt milk candy. I love that paragraph so much. That's a beautiful, beautiful paragraph.
Thank you.
So, how much work went into that?
I don't remember. You know,
yeah.
I wrote so much of that. I wrote a page and a quarter when I was working on it, and none of it was easy. It was like pushing a Buick with my forehead. Really hard. That was the most difficult book to write, yeah.
Well, it's 400 and some pages. You've got more than 100 footnotes. And the footnotes are just jammed in there. There's no rhyme or reason until you get the rhythm of this thing. And once you get the rhythm of it, it is breathtaking. So,
well, you know, I have to tell you, coming from you as a writer, that means a lot to me. Thank you. But that book was written during the saddest decade of my life. And I can open it to any page, and it makes me laugh. So it saved my life during a very sad time. My father was dying, and I knew he was going to die when I wrote that book because it was about him. And I said, if I don't write about my father, a Mexican immigrant, he doesn't count. He's not American history, so I must write it. And I just thought, if I write his story, it will kill him, you know, in a way. I just knew it. That's perhaps the clairvoyant part of me. And my father did indeed die when I was writing his story. But then once he died, he helped me write it. Yes, because my father was dead, but he wasn't gone. I could feel him, and I could feel his love. And I didn't know that people could send you love after death. You know, I never saw that on CNN. And I thought, dang, my father's still sending me love. I could feel it. I could feel it viscerally. And so I thought, well, in that case, will you help me write a page and a quarter? And so I would meditate and open the door to the meditation by sending my father love and inhaling his love. I send him love and I inhale his love. And then I get into the state of grace. And then I ask his parents and their parents, and then I'm surrounded by all these ancestors, and I ask for their courage, and I ask to do work that makes them proud. And I say, please help me. Your life was much more difficult than mine, and I have to do a page and a quarter before I go to bed. So then I ask La Virgen de Guadalupe to cover me with her rebozo of stars, and I want her to use me to speak through me, to do the highest work I can do. And then I close and I thank everyone. And that's how I write, even now.
That's how you got through that book?
That's how I write all the time.
Wow.
It taught me that I can meditate by first connecting with love to my spirit allies. And I do that anytime I write since then.
You know, the way you describe that, and early in your life, the way you've described the things you sacrificed to be a writer, that what you wanted to do was this kind of central vocational call, and yet you made a list of all the things you'd rather do than write. I have the list.
Okay, let's hear it.
I have the list. A cartoon voiceover actor.
I think I'd be good, right?
A flamenco dancer. An opera singer.
Maybe.
An accordion player. A comedian.
I wish.
A shoe designer. A popcorn vendor. A dog sitter. A window dresser. A textile curator. A florist. A henna hand painter. Or a judge on RuPaul's Drag Race.
Yes. 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 I think I would be very good on RuPaul's Drag Race. Yeah. I love drag queens. I love RuPaul. I love the drag queens in San Miguel in Mexico. I think drag queens are the sacred clowns of our society. They make us laugh. And we need to laugh right now. Yeah.
What I was going for was, what was going on when you made that list?
Well, that was a long time ago. I might edit some of those off. I think if I was going to be anything besides a writer, it probably would be something with textiles. I love cloth. I love fashion. And right now I'm doing a project with textiles and text with a clothing designer just on my spare time.
Well, and you write about it so beautifully in Carmelo, the shawls and Rebozo. Yeah.
I collect shawls and Mexican vintage and vintage towels and camisoles or anything I can write on. And then I have someone embroider over the
sure.
textiles.
Let's go back to your dad for a minute, because he was the audience you wanted, but all he did, you said, was read sports and comics. And
yeah.
So do you still feel like when you're writing, you're trying to get his attention?
Well, my father is spirit now, and he's present, and he's probably here right now. Yeah, very proud. So I don't feel like I have to get his attention. I think he's very present in my creations in a way he wasn't in the past. So I don't feel I have to get his approval. I feel I have to make change in the world now. It's not for my father. I have to keep your spirits alive and remind you that you can make change in the world. That's what I have to get the team going. Mm-hmm. And I also feel like I would like to reach people who don't think like me and change their mind about the community I love. Yeah. I do.
What about libraries? How did they factor into your reading and writing life?
Well, if it hadn't been for the Chicago Public Library, I wouldn't be here. So I love librarians, libraries. You know, for people who can't afford books, a public library is life-changing. If my grandparents hadn't emigrated 100 years ago from Mexico during the Civil War, And say I had been born in Mexico, where I live now, I would not be an author. No, because if you're born poor in Mexico, you die poor. And we were just very lucky that a civil war pushed them out. And my mother, you know, she never finished ninth grade, but she loved art, music, books, opera. And all of that opened the door for her children. And by the way, House on Mango Street is premiering this summer at the Glimmer Glass Festival as an opera. Yeah. And that was something I got as a kid, because my mom would take us to Grant Park to hear arias, to hear bits and pieces from operas. We listened to opera in my house on records she borrowed from the Chicago Public Library. So libraries really have shaped me.
Do you want to sing something from that opera?
I'm sorry?
Do you want to sing something from that opera?
Oh, you can look it up. Google House on Mango Street, arias, opera. The composer is Derek Bermel, and he's a genius. And maybe next time I'll sing something for
him. Yeah, I'll give you a warning. Yeah, you'll be ready. But so both House on Mango Street and Carmelo are so much of your story is in there.
Yeah.
Why choose fiction? Why not do them both as nonfiction?
Because there's so many parallels.
In Mexican families, they only tell you a lie. They don't tell you what really happened, you know? And my father would tell me, don't write about those things. You know, he would only give us a little bit of the story, little bits and pieces. They don't tell you everything, so you have to invent. Yeah.
Okay, so that fiction was a way to fill in the gaps.
Sure. Yeah, okay. Exactly.
So I love how you describe your writing process, by the way. You said, I can't explain my process. I just know that when I'm given a topic, I can only try but give no guarantees. It's like fishing. I can get up early, mend the nets, get my boat ready, and row myself to an area where there are plenty of fish. But I can't guarantee my catch. It's just I'm just the fisherman, not the creator of the fish. It's a matter of waiting. Sometimes you get a tug on the line and reel it in. So here's my question. That's a beautiful statement, by the way. Here's my question. All the writing you've done for all these years, the word sometimes sticks in my mind. You still only get sometimes a tug on your line?
Yes. It's still a matter of getting out of the way. It's a matter of humility and of service. If I think, oh, I want to win this prize, no. You really have to come from a place of love and no ego. No ego, no personal agenda. You have to put yourself in service to those you love. And House taught me that, you know, not right away, but 20 years later, that whatever you create with love on behalf of those you love, con amor puro y puro amor, siempre sale bonito. It always turns out well. But you have to get out of the way. Yeah. And I think that's a law about anything you do, whatever you do with love on behalf of those you love with no personal agenda will always turn out well.
How much does it sting when a library or a school bans your book?
Well, you know, that's happening now in South Texas to a Christian group. And I'm very spiritual, so I want to go talk to them.
But it's happened for years. This isn't something new.
Oh, well, that happened in Arizona, but that was because the politicians banned it, and they don't read books, so you know. I didn't take it personally. They just kind of erased the whole Mexican-American studies. But you know, there was a lawsuit. It got put back in. But in South Carolina and South Texas and the Rio Grande Valley right now, some Christian groups are pushing to remove many books, especially by gay writers.
So what I was moved by, though, was with one particular person who wrote to you and complained that her daughter was reading House on Mango Street, you wrote back to her. And my question is, why? Why not just
agent said why?
why not just ignore the haters?
Because I think we can get more done talking to one another and coming to a respectful place. And I just feel that there isn't enough respectful speech and respectful listening. And so I felt I'm going to pretend I'm writing to my father. And we disagreed a lot. So I wrote to her first an angry letter, and I kept revising and revising till it came to a really respectful place. And we did an exchange.
It was very respectful. Do you remember what you said to her?
I'm sorry?
Do you remember what you said to her?
Yes, it's in my book, House of My Own. I published my letter, and I asked if I could publish her letter, but she said no, and that's okay. But she came around, and I had to explain to her that she was coming from a place of fear. And when you're coming from a place of fear, you can't think straight. You have wrong perceptions. I really believe that we're in a state of fear, and globally, but especially in our nation right now, and that fear is being stoked so we don't think straight. Because if we thought straight, we would come from a place of love, from our highest power. And we need to clear out the fear. Yeah. It helps me to be a little compassionate about the way the nation voted, because I feel there are consequences to where we're going. A lot of people are going to lose jobs. The poorest, the weakest parts of our society are going to suffer. And I hope that that will allow our community to wake up.
Sure. Me too. What kind of advice would you have for the writers in the audience? Give us your best writing advice.
Well, there's two kinds of writers. There's writers for yourself, for clarity, for getting rid of fear or negative emotions so that you can get right perception. And then there's the writers who are doing the work of writing to publish. So I think for both of them, it's very important that you meditate, that you do work of like shutting the phone and shutting things down and listening to your heart, and that you develop a practice of meditating. And if you think, oh, that's too hard, you could do it with a guided meditation, but it's important that you listen to your heart. Whether you're going to publish or not, that would be one of the things. If you're going to publish, I would recommend you find a community of writers that can help you edit your work, because you can't become a professional writer in isolation. You write in isolation, but you edit with others. And eventually, you won't need a whole group. You just need one or two editors. But you do have to develop your skills. It's like if you want to become an Olympic gymnast. Well, you're not going to make it to the Olympics if you're just hanging from a tree. No. So you just have to know, you know, you got to go, you know, study with the lady at the dance studio, and then she's going to send you to the coach, and then you're going to go like that until eventually one day you make it to the Olympics. It's like that.
So here's one other piece of advice that I'd like you to embellish, where you've said the best stories are the ones we can't tell.
Well, I think the best stories for ourselves are the ones we haven't written down or admitted or spoken, and they frighten us, but it's important that we release them, either in song or dance or painting or poetry or prose, because if you hold them for too long, especially if they're painful, they can make you sick. And you need to desahogarte, you need to undrown from the stories you witness, the things you wish you could forget. You need to put that load down.
And writing would do that.
Yes, or painting or singing or any other art.
Okay. You have a beautiful poem that I would love for us to close our conversation with.
Yeah, I have to explain something. In the poem, it talks about a caucus, and I don't mean a political caucus. I'm talking about Alice in Wonderland. And there's a scene in Alice in Wonderland where Alice and all the animals are in a caucus race. They just start wherever they are, and they just run and run and run and run. And when they finish, they say, "Who won?" And so this poem's about that. When in doubt, wear faux leopard. When in doubt, err on the side of generosity. When in doubt, greet everyone as you would the Buddha. When in doubt, collect blessings from those who own nothing. When in doubt, absorb biographies to avoid life's major mistakes. When in doubt, make life's major mistakes. When in doubt, pay attention to the vendor shouting, "Dios!" Even when you find out he was only shouting, "Gas!" When in doubt, carry a handkerchief and a fan. When in doubt, thank everyone twice. When in doubt, heed the clouds. When in doubt, sleep on it. When in doubt, treat all sentient and insentient beings as kin. When in doubt, forgive us our myopia as we forgive those who are myopic against us. When in doubt, unreel your grief to a tree. When in doubt, remember this: we are all on a caucus race. There is no start, no finish. Everyone wins.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.